This is a download of Farming Today from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk. The presenter today, Anna Hill.
Good morning. The government wants farmers to cut ammonia emissions. How does this work in practice and at what cost? We'll have more on that in a moment. First, though, today, the number of curlews has dropped in the last decade. Well, now farmers along the Welsh border are helping to protect them. A local conservation group called Curlew Country has received a lottery grant of £65,000. Amanda Perkins from Curlew Country told BBC Radio Shropshire's Faith Page why she feels saving the curlew is crucial.
It's considered to be the most important species now within the UK for conservation. So it is a really important bird. It's an iconic bird and it's a bird we all love. And it's not a bird of reserves. Locally it nests on farmland, but the farmers absolutely love this bird. So it's a great bird where we can work in these really productive partnerships to achieve for wildlife.
Bob and Jill Jarman, talking about farmers there, you do love this bird, don't you?
We certainly do, yes. It is such an unusual bird, but the sound of it is just so magical. You just have to stop in your tracks and listen to it. And to lose that would be, well, it would just be devastating.
And the bird was part of your childhood?
Yes. Obviously, years ago, we used to go around the nests in the hayfield and leave the birds there. And you'd see them regularly. But now it's a rare sight to see even one chick or even to see the adults.
How about you, Bob? How important is the bird to you?
Well, it brings back so many memories. I can remember harvesting and you'd see them scuttling through the hay. So you wouldn't go to that part of the field, you'd go to another part and hopefully they'd go. And they always did. They always went into the neighbouring field. Yeah, so it's memories like that you'd hate to lose, and you'd for your children to see them as well. It'd be such a great loss if they were to go.
Yes. Yeah. Do you agree? This is your daughter here. Yes. Yeah. What's your name?
Michelle Jarman.
What do you think of the curlew?
It's a really beautiful sound, but obviously haven't heard it as often. But living in the countryside, it's something. One of the joys of living in the countryside is all the natural birds and all the sounds, and you know, to lose it would be catastrophic.
So what is it that you guys are doing to help protect this bird?
Last year we put a fence up around our patch of land. We were going to put a small fence, but we actually secluded half of the field, and that was quite successful until chick stage, at which stage they got predated, sadly.
Fox?
We don't know.
So what more can be done to protect them at the later stage?
We have to do predation control. That's the bottom line.
That's what does that entail?
Well, that would be taking out foxes that were too prolific. Obviously we can't do anything with badgers because they're protected. But that's just another issue that we have to deal with, and somehow we have to try and look after them as best we can with the facilities we've got.
Farmer Jill Jarman there. There's sometimes a perception that small farms and food chains might have higher animal welfare standards than the big international food companies. In 2012, a global system was launched called the Business Benchmark on Farm Animal Welfare to ensure high standards in international food systems. Well, all this week we're looking at aspects of animal welfare. Nikki Amos is the chief executive of the Business Benchmark scheme. She told Mark Smalley where it stands today, involving large international food groups like Unilever, Nestle, KFC, Walmart and McDonald's.
We have a significant number of companies now that are not just publishing clear policies, but they're demonstrating the actions behind those policies to drive animal welfare standards in their operations and supply chains.
There is no baseline criteria, is there, for what they do publish?
There isn't, and there is no, unlike certain other corporate responsibility areas like climate change, for example, there is no baseline standard for companies on animal welfare, and there's no universal legislation, of course, on animal welfare. So it's fair to say that for many companies, they were unsure of the reasons to report or even what they should report on if they were reporting. What we've managed to do through the Business Benchmark is provide a normative framework that encourages companies to report on a level playing field, really. So we set out very clear criteria, 34 criteria, in fact, on what we expect companies to be reporting and sharing in the public domain in a very transparent way.
But of the 110 plus companies who you've reported on in your most recent report, 42 of them, that's 40%, saw no importance really around improved welfare. That's nearly half. How do you tackle that?
I think it demonstrates that there are many companies at the beginning of the journey on animal welfare. So we have a number of companies that are either not acknowledging animal welfare as an important business issue or are really not reporting on it in a meaningful way. We expect these companies over time, with increased interest from consumers and also investors who really take notice of the benchmark increasingly, we're expecting those companies to respond to this expectation to become more transparent on what they're doing on this issue. And they see that animal welfare is becoming more of a competitive issue in their industry. You know, they are actively looking to see what their direct industry peers are doing in this space and who's being acknowledged for better welfare and better reporting on their welfare. And as we're moving more towards performance outcomes, we're looking at the ways in which companies are measuring the effectiveness of their policies and their commitments, and we're seeing that translated into welfare outcomes. I think we're going to start to see a lot more competition amongst companies to demonstrate that they are really delivering improvements for animals.
Nikki Amos there. A new initiative by the Environment Secretary Michael Gove to reduce harmful air pollution will target farms releasing ammonia into the atmosphere. We'll hear more about that in just a moment. But wood burners and coal fires are also identified as air polluting sources. The government has said it won't ban the use of existing wood burners or coal fires. Instead, new wood burners would be cleaner and there may be coal-free days in some areas. But nevertheless, the price of timber and firewood has risen 30% over the last year, according to new figures from the Forestry Commission. The forestry body Comfor is now encouraging farmers in England to plant more woodland, and one of the areas it's identified for investment is Cumbria. Our reporter Kaz Graham has been to visit a wood pulp processing plant near Workington on the West Cumbrian coast to hear how their operation works.
11 million tonnes of UK roundwood, that is the trunks and the branches, was delivered to processors in 2016 to places like this. I'm in West Cumbria and I'm at the Iggesund Paper Board Mill. This is a massive site, it's about 100 acres, lots of big industrial buildings, silos, elevators, a huge amount of timber in front of me, and I am with Ian Black. Ian, we've got stacks and stacks of wood here. What is this wood and where's it come from?
This full site takes 900,000 tonnes a year of wood. All of this wood comes from the UK, from Scotland and Northern England, and it's all sustainably sourced.
And this is coniferous wood, spruce, all of this stuff like that?
All of the wood for our pulp-making process, which is extremely critical, is Sitka spruce.
And we can see a whole fleet of machinery with big grabbers, and they're taking stacks of what look like about 40 or 50 of these, well, effectively tree trunks in one go, and loading them onto a big conveyor belt over there. What happens to it now?
They're offloaded by the cranes here, and they're put into big stacks. The logs then go into a big tumbling debarking drum where they're literally just tumbled round and round and round. So then the debarked logs feed straight into our chipper. And then behind us here, we have our two big sawmill chip piles. These wood chips in front of us are about a 1-inch square chip, and that's very, very critical to our pulp making process. And you can also see they're very bright. And in front of us here, we have about 3 days' worth of production.
Explain, Ian, what you make here.
We're making a product called folding boxboard, and this is a sustainable packaging-grade paperboard. It's used for very high-end packaging, and we're supplying approximately 40% of the UK market for folding boxboard. We also have very big export markets in Europe as well.
Is there enough timber in the UK for all of the processors like yourselves who want to use it?
There is enough timber for us, and we have a very secure supply through our forestry management activities outside in the forest areas. We're taking about, well, just slightly less than 10% of the full UK harvest, actually, every year.
Now, this is what I call a roll of cardboard. We're standing underneath these huge rolls that have just come off the production line. Ian, tell me about these.
We call these jumbo reels, and these are wound directly off the board machine. There's about 15 tonnes in each one, so we're producing packaging directly for our market, but its foundation stone is absolutely the forest and the secure source of sustainable wood, actually, because without that, we don't have anything.
Ian, it's been absolutely fascinating. Thank you so much for showing me around.
Thank you very much.
That was Kaz Graham in Cumbria there. Well, the new move to cut air pollution will mean farmers will have to reduce the amount of ammonia from muck and slurry going into the atmosphere. It's thought 80% of ammonia pollution is caused by farms. The government has indicated that farmers could be supported with funding from a public money for public goods subsidy system to make the changes. I asked Professor Keith Goulding from Rothamsted Research how farmers can cut back ammonia emissions.
The simple ways are, first of all, to cover the slurry store, for example, because that prevents the ammonia from being lost into the atmosphere. But also it's possible to acidify the slurry. That reduces the pH because ammonia is lost under alkaline pH conditions. And so acidifying the slurry reduces the pH and that reduces the ammonia emissions.
So do you add something to it?
Yes, sulfuric acid is the normal source of acidity. We've talked about storage. The next stage is the spreading. The most common way of spreading it, of course, is the old-fashioned, it's called a splash plate, where the slurry is put into a tanker and it is shot out of the back and spread all over the field, which gives you a nice even spread over the field. But as you can, and listeners imagine, as the slurry is shooting out through the air, there's a huge loss of ammonia. So the techniques that have been tested again and found to be very successful are the injection of the slurry, either into slots in the soil or using tubes to deposit it below the grass surface. It's usually done to grassland so that it's on the top of the soil and it's not sprayed around in the atmosphere. And that reduces emissions by a very large amount. But of course, the kit, the equipment to do that is expensive. But because of the cost, it's either a major investment for the farm or it requires some kind of subsidy to encourage them to do it.
But it does mean generally it would be more expensive to farm if you have to clear up all the ammonia on the farm, basically.
Yes, that's correct.
When you're talking about sustainable farming, though, using muck on the land is a process that, you know, has a virtuous circle, doesn't it? So that, you know, you're producing waste, but that's going back on the land to grow the next crop. So it would be a shame if that didn't happen anymore.
Absolutely. It's essential that we recycle what we used to call wastes, which of course are an important resource of nutrients and carbon, organic matter for the soil. And so what we need is not just a simple one problem solution, but we need to look in an integrated, a holistic way of what's the most sustainable way to farm. And that must include recycling manures and slurries to land.
How much reduction do you think farmers could achieve? Because they are targeted in this report as, you know, one of the major causes of air pollution.
Yes, by switching fertilisers, not very much, but by reducing emissions from slurries and manures in storage and when they apply it to land, then the reductions are considerable. I think up to something like 80%. So a very significant amount. But as we've discussed, it's likely to come with a significant cost to the farm.
Professor Keith Goulding there from Rothamsted Research. And that's all from us this morning. I'm Anna Hill. The producer in Bristol is Beatrice Fenton.